And we welcome you back. As we observe Veterans Day, we're going to take a few moments for a Vietnam retrospective of sorts. This Sunday, one of the St. Louis International Film Festival films takes a look at one aspect of the war, the misinformation that got us into that bloody conflict, and five Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists who fought to give the American public the truth during the war's earliest days. They are David Halberstam, Malcolm Brown, Neil Sheehan, Peter Arnett, and photojournalist Horst Voss. The film is Dateline Saigon, and largely represents the work of Richard Chapman, senior lecturer in screenwriting at Washington University and executive producer of Dateline Saigon. Richard, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on a very significant day.
It is a significant day, and that's one of the reasons you're here. This is a significant film. I have to tell you, I watched it, and I thought it was very powerful, and I would recommend it to everyone, but certainly to young journalists. It's very, very inspiring what these five gentlemen and others did during those war's earliest days. How did you get into it?
Well, it grew out of, I come from a journalistic background. My dad was a reporter, and my brother was a publisher of a newspaper. And so I naturally have followed a lot of stories over the years. But a longtime friend of mine, who was also a co-producer and involved with a film that I wrote for HBO called Live from Baghdad, which, of course, dealt with the CNN coverage, first people behind enemy lines to report a story live. And it's been about 14 years now. My friend Tom Herman came to me with a project that was in the works. He had already interviewed Walter Cronkite and several other people, and he had a grand design to cover all of the journalists that he could find that had reported the war in for photojournalism, print journalism, electronic journalism, and spanning a number of years. It was a very ambitious project, and over the years we collected 50 interviews and hundreds of hours to go through before we finally winnowed it down into the current cut that we are showing.
Obviously a time-consuming job. I mean, the film is out now, but three of the five reporters that I mentioned are no longer with us. I mean, and some haven't been with us for a few years.
That's true. Over the years, we have been working very closely with the five characters that we finally decided to focus on. As you mentioned, David and Malcolm have passed away, and Horst as well. Neil Sheehan is still around and very vibrant, and we just had a screening at the museum in Washington, D.C., and Neil did a wonderful Q&A afterwards. And so we were fortunate. In David's case, it was a tragic accident that took him from us. The others had lived pretty full lives and over the years had the opportunity to collect their memoirs. And so we had a great resource, a large library of information. And then it took David, really, became sort of the quarterback of this group to give us a point of view. And we really keyed off of him because he was one of the first people in there and probably of the five was the most seasoned because they were all very young men.
Well, that's a point I wanted to make. All of them were under the age of 30. And that was not by accident. They were because they were young, that's why they were sent in. I guess they figured this was going to be a short affair and that they'd send the green kids in to cover it.
Exactly, because this was seen by many as a nice little war in a land of tigers and elephants, as the quaint phrase to describe it went. And they were going to send the rookies into this backwater and, you know, trial by fire for them. And of course, it was a chance of a lifetime for the journalists.
And they took full advantage of it. They were very, very smart and very collegial, too. I mean, we think of journalism as being a very competitive profession, which it is. But under these circumstances, some of them worked fairly closely together, even though they worked for rival organizations.
Yeah. Well, it started out as fiercely competitive because it was known as the last great wire service battle between United Press International and Associated Press, and then David representing the New York Times. And Horst was kind of a wild card. He was working for AP, but he was a German photojournalist, and Peter Arnett, who had come from New Zealand. So it was AP versus UPI, and Neil Sheehan was alone, so he kind of teamed up with Halberstam. So it became Halberstam and Sheehan versus the three guys from AP. Then, when things started getting tense over the first year, it became apparent that they had to band together and work as a team to get out the truth.
And things became tense because what they were reporting was not in concert with what the government was reporting, not by a long shot.
Well, it happened very quickly in Malcolm Brown's case. He had arrived in his woolen suit in the heat of the tropical heat of Saigon, and the first thing he noticed when he was coming into the Caravelle Hotel in Saigon was that there was an American aircraft carrier coming up the river. So he said, this is noteworthy. It was the USS Cole. And he went over to the American embassy and asked them, what's the story on the aircraft carrier there? And they looked at him and just blankly said, what aircraft carrier? And that kind of was a message delivered to get on the team, which was a recurring message that was delivered in many different ways to all of these guys as they realized that they were in the fight of their lives against much, much more powerful and seasoned veterans, the entire Kennedy administration during the period that we covered later on. Other journalists ran into the Johnson administration and then the Nixon administration. There were five presidents throughout the entire Vietnam conflict.
Yeah. And that the earliest days, we're talking about the first year or so of the war, the principles on the other side, the government side, did not come off at all well in this film. I mean, clearly they were just not telling the truth to the American people.
Well, the problem for the president and the secretary of state and all of the military cabinet members, and they had just come off of two it was not a good period for them in that the Cuban Missile Crisis as well as trying to stop the domino effect was their principal agenda. And having the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis and then Vietnam, which was kind of the hat trick of bad things happening to this administration, they had to dig their heels in and try to figure out a way to contain all of these situations, especially within coming straight out of the Cold War. And don't forget, we weren't all that far away from World War II.
No, that's right. We're 15, 16 years, something like that, needless. But one of the lines I recall from the film, just referring to my notes here, was that the government was referred to, I think by one of the reporters, as a vast lying machine.
Right. It became readily apparent that the facts were not squaring with what they saw on the ground. They would go out, the body counts in particular were vastly overdrawn by the military authorities. And then when the journalists went out into the field with the military officials who were then called advisors, we didn't have troops there. We had advisors there. And those advisors began to swell in numbers and look disturbingly like troops. But they would go out the generals would put out the story that 300 Viet Cong had been killed in an after-action report, and maybe one South Vietnamese Arvin helicopter had gone down. Well, when they got out in the field, they saw maybe three Viet Cong bodies, 25 to 30 Arvin soldiers, fatalities, and seven helicopters. Now, that didn't make – it made the papers, and that made Kennedy irate, and the conflict then was on.
It also gave the reporters, some of them anyway, their spurs in learning how to report, because they had – and with this particular incident that you're referring to with 300 reported dead by the government – I think there were 12, maybe there was something like that, that they learned never to rely on government sources for that kind of information.
Well, they knew that they were being manipulated, managed, and lied to, and this did cause a great degree of improvisation in how they got their stories out, because don't forget, we didn't have cell phones, we didn't have instantaneous communication, no internet certainly, and they became quite adept at getting stories out with, for instance, they called them stewardesses at the time, Pan Am flight attendants would take their copy out and get it to Tokyo, where they would then put it on the wire services, and in extreme instances where there was a technological malfunction in getting their wire reports out directly from their headquarters. Horst Voss, the photojournalist whose pictures are unbelievable from that period, had taken over the bathroom at the UPI AP headquarters and turned it into a darkroom. So these guys were really thinking on their feet. They were exchanging ideas and thoughts. And remarkably so, that's when the competition became collaboration amongst the five guys.
You mentioned Foss, and I wanted to get to that too, because the Vietnam War is often referred to as the living room war because of television and the fact that every night – it was 24 hours late, the video that we saw in those days, but every night we would watch what was going on there. But the role of still photographers and still photography was enormous, particularly during these early days.
And these were very beautifully shot. It's an irony that the carnage and the awful events that they depict, but they're done in an artistic fashion, because Horst was a real art photographer in terms of how he would light things and using natural light and coming into these scenes and depicting the drama. So in this way, I think the impact was greater than in some ways than we'll see everything now. We'll see it with cell phones, but back then you had a picture on the front page of a New York Times or other newspapers on your breakfast table. So it's, as opposed to the living room war, I would characterize this as a breakfast table war, in which the next day, after you've had a good night's sleep, you get up and you're faced with a clean slate that you filled with the news that was coming out from these men who were not manipulated. They were telling the truth.
One of the most iconic photographs, and there were several, obviously, during the course of the war, but one of the most iconic was shot by Neil Sheehan, I believe it was, who shot the self-immolation of the Buddhist
Malcolm
monk.
Brown.
I beg your pardon, sure. Malcolm Brown, sure. That really had people stand up at their breakfast table and say, what the heck is going on here?
Absolutely. And were they able to have broadcast it on television? This is, you've hit a very interesting point, because we had the actual motion picture footage from start to finish of him getting out of the cab, the self-immolation, the horror, and the actual dissipation of the body into ashes in front of us. So we had the choice. Are we going to show that in the film? Of course not, because what we're talking about is one of the greatest photojournalists of all time. So we used and ironically, Horst didn't take that shot. Malcolm Brown took it, and he was, the purporter, but he took his camera because he was tipped off and he thought something might happen. So we used the frames of – in almost stop motion. It's a harrowing but very – you can't take your eyes off it in the course of the film.
Why was that photograph so important?
Well, first of all, it crystallized – the situation in Vietnam, where you had a president and his brother who were in the Catholic minority. They were despots that were propped up by –
This is the president of Vietnam.
Of South Vietnam.
South Vietnam, yeah.
The Diem brothers. And they were propped up by our military and State Department, and because, once again, we wanted to hold the line against communism. Unfortunately, the Diem brothers, in their move to keep their power, had started to crack down on Buddhist protests. And Buddhism is the majority, the religion of the majority in South Vietnam. So these Buddhists were taken and herded into trucks reminiscent of Nazi brutality in the Holocaust. And so what happened was, this particular photo, and accompanying this, we have a motion picture of the Buddhist priest being herded into the trucks, and we have, within context. But then it just stops time. It freezes. The tableau of the absolute dedication and fierce convictions of the Buddhists, and to see this in a horrifying yet fascinating depiction was very dramatic and for us. And so I think that it did show us that who was at stake here in the Vietnam conflict, because it was such a complicated issue of North versus South, Catholic versus Buddhist, the communist versus the West. So issues became very complex, and this was a flashpoint for us in our film and in the narrative to get that point across.
I think of a couple of other photographs that of that time which were so striking, and I still can see them very clearly in my mind. The young girl naked running
sure.
toward the camera after, I guess it
Kim
was
– Fook.
Yeah. Right. After the bodies in the trench at My Lai is another one that comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
The execution of a suspect on the street by
yes.
one of Diem's policemen, I guess it was. Photographs that just burn in your brain.
Now, that photo, to show you the complexities of the issues, we all have seen the execution of the Viet Cong officer in the streets. Well, the man who had executed him had just prior to that witnessed his entire family being executed by the Viet Cong. And Eddie Adams, who took the picture, he's showing you the truth. But you don't have the context. Very few people have really realized, and there's a story that was written about that, mm-hmm. but that the image has been seared on our memories. And this is how suddenly the truth can be used as a point of view, whether it's by the military, whether the government, or certainly by journalists at a certain point. And the truth is not just a point of view. So context becomes all important, and verification and sources, and that's what we're losing today. Journalists today, the bloggers and the internet reporters and your citizen journalists, although there's a big upside to it. The downside is there's very little verification, and people, these days it's you have to watch what you tweet.
Yeah, and when you're reading that tweet, you have to be careful about evaluating. Yeah, and passing it on. Tell me something about gathering this material. You have a lot of archival stuff, some of which has never been seen before, at least not by a wide audience.
This is the most frustrating part of the 14 years of putting this together. There were so many different facets of journalism and so many different stories in the Vietnam years, which, by the way, are like 20 years. And goes back even to the Truman years. Did you know that in 1950, Truman sent advisors to the South Vietnamese at that point? So over all of these years, we had gotten women journalists like Gloria Emerson and Frankie Fitzgerald. We had wonderful interviews with them, Kate Webb. We had crazy things like Errol Flynn's son going off into the Cambodian jungle and disappearing. We had the last footage of him on a motorcycle. A lot of this stuff just didn't fit into the confines of when we started focusing on the earlier 61 through 65. And we had television stuff with Morley Safer, although he did make it into the film because there's some interesting things where, the quote, famous quote, we had to destroy the village to save it. We had the original Zippo lighter on the village's thatched roofs. So the frustration was, how do you take all of this large body of reporting and make it accessible to, first of all, a younger audience, because we're not interested in just the people that experienced it. I have students in my screenwriting class when we're talking about Vietnam. It's such a cursory brush over for them in history courses. They get, a lot about the colonial times and the founding of the nation, and then by the time they hit Vietnam, it's, oh, yes, and then there was this war that we lost.
That's why this film, I think, is so very important. I mean, we can't forget that time, particularly now. And I'm wondering what you think, having gone through this process of putting this film together, starting with the fact that we sent 50 advisors to Vietnam to get the whole ball rolling, as it turned out. You think we're doing the same thing now in the Middle East with regard to the ground troops that we're sending into to Syria?
Well, it is eerily similar in many respects that, you start down a slippery slope as soon as you begin to get, the advisors. That's a tough position to be in. And where do you draw the line? You increase your number of advisors, and that's what happened in Vietnam. And before you knew it, there were like 5,000, quote, advisors in there. Because these conflicts, these brush fire wars are very difficult to contain for military and for our government. We want to help these people. But in a situation like Syria, which gets even more complicated when another nation, Russia, comes in, and now we also have this almost a reboot of the Cold War, so Cold War 2.0. So complicating all of this is the idea that the commitment that presidents have to make, and then they have to follow through, or they're accused of, once you're in, it's difficult not to follow through. And I think that's pretty much the trend of what's happening now. And it is of concern to in a lot of quarters.
It's scary. For those of us who lived through that period, it is scary. There's no question about it. And by the way, that's one of the stories that the reporters that you feature in your film brought to light, was the fact that the number of these advisors was continually increasing, a big part of your tale.
And they were becoming more difficult to conceal because in one case we chronicle Malcolm Brown doing a story about the war in the air, and certainly the South Vietnamese had an air force, but this is the interesting thing. A lot of the people, the pilots, were American flyers who were in the front seat with their hand on the machine guns. So, as they said, the big noses did all the shooting, as was reported from eyewitness accounts from some of the Vietnamese who were looking at, Big Brother coming in and taking over their plane and getting the job done.
I saw something like that in Honduras many years ago, and we weren't supposed to be there. But on an airfield, there were a bunch of planes sitting around that had been painted over. You could still see the American insignia under the first coat of paint.
Sure.
And we were telling the world that we were not there, and obviously we were.
The most important aspect of the journalism, though, in addition to getting the truth, was the context of, and I think this is what we really went to great lengths to emphasize.
It'll have to be quick.
Okay, these young men came in as patriots. They came out of the Cold War generation of duck and cover, so they thought they were in a just cause. And then when they were lied to, that changed the game.
Richard Chapman, thank you for being with us. I'll point out Dateline Saigon shows this Sunday at 7:30 at Washington University's Brown Hall Auditorium. It's a must-see. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the history of black activism on college campuses and how it relates to the situation at Mizzou. We'll also speak with Toni Tipton Martin about her book, The Jemima Code, which takes a look at the contributions by African-American women in America's food culture. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. The program is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.